and welcome back to the Health Tech Pigeon podcast, which was referred to this week by Vishal Varani as having delivering more value than all of the pigeons in Trafalgar Square. And given the number of pigeons in Trafalgar Square, I will take that because that's quite a lot of value. So thank you, Vishal. And for those of you who are first-time listeners or new listeners, we break down the health tech news every single week so that you don't have to. And this week, we are joined by another very, very special guest, co-founder of Booby Biome, Dr. Sinead Jones. Welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm super excited to be on the podcast. So thanks for having me.
Absolute pleasure. Well, I'm also joined by wonderful producer Adma, who keeps us all in line, all in check every week and makes sure that everything that you hear sounds semi-sensible. And my colleague, James, and co-founder James.
And husband James now, by the way, so you can include that.
And husband James, yes. Welcome, husband James. That will still be novelty for a little while to come, I'm sure. But yes, we did get married, so pigeon norbitals. Anyway, so enough of that. Let's talk about something interesting and health tech related. So I am very excited to hear... Well, do you know what? I love talking about the microbiome. I'm all about the gut microbiome. And it was only when I heard Sinead speak, maybe just over a year ago, that the word breast microbiome even came into my consciousness. I had no idea what it was or that even it existed. So why don't you just tell us a little bit about what it is and what it is that you're doing at Booby Biome?
Of course. So as you said, we know that there is a microbiome, so a community of bacteria in our gut, on our skin, but there is also a breast milk microbiome. And there's actually 200 different types of bacteria that live in it. And these are passed from mother to baby, and it is a key factor that shapes infant health. So once these beneficial breast milk bacteria arrive and colonize the infant gut, these have a wide range of roles. They can inhibit the growth of pathogenic bacteria, aid digestion, train the immune system, maintain the gut integrity. So it is really remarkable what these breast milk bacteria do. And actually, I always get asked, well, where do these breast milk bacteria come from? And it's such a good question because no one really knows. We have some evidence that show that some come from the mother's skin, or from the baby's mouth, so when the baby is latching and suckling. But in addition to that, we also know that a lot of these breast milk bacteria are in fact gut bacteria. And we know that during this third trimester of pregnancy, the maternal gut actually becomes very permeable and leaky. And what we believe is happening is that the gut bacteria from the mother is actually traveling from the gut lumen into the lactating mammary gland by translocation. So essentially jumping a ride on a white cell. And that's really worth mentioning because it just shows how a woman's body can orchestrate such intricate processes to protect her child, even at the microbial level. And that's something that we just find so fascinating. But then in addition to these bacteria that live in breast milk, we also have what's called human milk oligosaccharides, or HMOs. And these are prebiotic or sugars. There's around 200 of them that's been identified in breast milk. The amount can change from mother to mother, depending on things like genetics, geography, diet. But these HMOs have puzzled scientists for years because babies can't digest them. They don't have the right enzymes to digest them. But what we realized was that these HMOs feed the bacteria in the breast milk microbiome and in the infant gut, but they feed a very specific type of bacteria called Bifidobacterium. And these really are the superstars when it comes to the breast milk microbiome and the infant gut, because these are really the ones that's producing the metabolites that can train the immune system, or producing lactic acid and acetate that can lower the pH of the gut, that can stop these pathogenic bacteria from going. And really, these are the ones that have the positive implications on health and just shows why breastfeeding is so important. But as you can imagine, a lot of babies don't have access to these beneficial breast milk bacteria. And we know from studies that this can have a very detrimental impact on health. So a study that I always like talking about is one by Professor Megan Azad in the States that showed that if a baby receives antibiotics in that first year of life and is not breastfed, it can increase the risk of asthma by 3 times. But if a baby has received antibiotics in that first year but is breastfed, it results in no change at the risk of asthma.
Wow.
So really showing just how important these breast milk microbiome bacteria are. But I guess we're just faced with this problem that there is an increase in C-section births, an increase in antibiotic usage, increase in formula, and also breastfeeding is just very difficult. It's a personal choice that can be influenced by various factors, and it's absolutely not an equal playing field. So at the moment, there are 2 options, you breastfeed or you formula feed. And I think that needs to be an improvement to the options available. And that's really where BoobieBiome comes in.
How? How does BoobieBiome come in? How is it solving it?
Of course. So for the last 5 years, we have been analysing breast milk donations from women across the UK. We have been analysing the milk using a process called shotgun metagenomics. And this allows us to map exactly what's living in the breast milk microbiome. So the bacteria, the viruses, the fungi, to strain level resolution. But we've also gone a step further and we've been sampling the infant microbiome stool as well, so that we can understand which bacteria in the breast milk microbiome are actually colonizing and doing something in the infant gut. Then all of our donors, they complete an extensive questionnaire so that we can understand how does things like diet, antibiotic usage, C-section births actually influence the breast milk microbiome and in turn the infant health. And the data that we've had from this has been truly fascinating. We've identified how some women are super donors, so they'll have huge abundance of bifidobacterium, for example. And we can track their milk over the course of their breastfeeding journey, but also from baby 1, baby 2, baby 3. So there's huge value in this database that we've built, and that's really what's driving innovation. But then in parallel to that, everything that we've found in this database, we've gone back to the breast milk itself and we've isolated the bacteria to build a biobank. So we have now a biobank of over 100 beneficial bacteria strains, and we're looking at every single one individually or in a community to make sure that we can have a product that mimics the breast milk microbiome ecosystem. But really, our mission is to support women throughout their whole infant feeding journey, whether they're breastfeeding, whether they're not. So I've spoken here about obviously a product that would be given to a baby if breast milk is not available. But during all of this collection and receiving donations, we discovered that when a mother stores her milk or pumps her milk, once that milk is exposed to oxygen in the air, some of these beneficial bacteria, which are anaerobic, are essentially destroyed. And so we had a little play around in the lab, and we built a device that essentially absorbs oxygen from breast milk and within the bottle. And then we went to look at, okay, well, what happens to these anaerobic bacteria now? And we saw that they were all preserved during storage for up to 7 days. We were actually also preserving the antioxidant content and preventing aerobic pathogenic bacteria from growing in the breast milk. So we're really super excited to be launching that to market pretty soon, actually, so that we can have products available for whoever you are at whatever point of the breastfeeding journey you are in.
I mean, that really is just mind-blowing. And I feel like I'm just starting to get to grips. I'm not starting to get to grips. I've got to grips with how hormones work and how hormones influence your body, whether you're male or female. And I guess like all of the intricate processes that are involved in keeping you alive and doing all the things that bodies do. And then I hear about something like this and it just makes me realize what a beautiful orchestra is going on in your body at any given time. And especially when it's a mother growing a baby and feeding a baby and all of those things that just seem like a crazy coincidence, but actually go towards creating and sustaining a life, and how so like something that could seem really innocuous during pregnancy or early in a baby's life then can go on and influence them it up through into adulthood. And it's absolutely just, yeah, mind blowing to me that that happens. And we're only just learning about this stuff. It's just fascinating. Really, really fascinating. James, how do you feel like as a guy, a man, hearing about how all of these processes and all of these like microbes are just swirling around and doing such incredible things that we were just never aware of? Like, is it something that, I don't know, it fascinates you as much as it does me?
Yeah, it does. I think it's funny that you say, like, as a man, it doesn't matter that I'm a man here. Like, we're talking about a baby. A baby is a product of two people. Yes, okay, the pregnancy and all the rest of it. Like, we're talking about getting a human, a new human, the microbiome that it needs. Of course, it's the mother that's going to breastfeed, and there's the connection that way. But I guess the angle that I come at it, not, I don't want to speak for all men here and men's reaction. I guess my instinctual reaction is one of a scientist, one of a doctor, one of, from that angle, you know what I mean? So from my perspective, I think I said this last time that we talked about BB Biome, like, the best ideas are the ones often where you think, like, why hasn't this been thought of before? Why hasn't this been done before? And I think that's the thing. I think maybe that having a child is something that's, I guess, transient in people's lives. They'll think about it deeply for one part of their life, and then they'll move on to the next stage, and you know, whatever their passions are and area that they want to focus on changes. And I think it is... And for me, it's an area that just makes sense. It just makes sense that we look at this stuff. It just makes sense that that breast milk will have a microbiome. The microbiome of the child, the baby, the gut microbiome will be important. You know, for all sorts of. I mean, you know, from when I did my neonate job, like, I know the importance of the gut in the neonate. The gut in the neonate is so unbelievably important, because the most dangerous things, arguably, that can affect the neonate, that kind of horrible Venn diagram of, I guess, most dangerous and most common, the overlap are some of the gut diseases that, you know, you'll just get bloating and swelling to a point of, yeah, disaster, basically. And so I think, yeah, it just makes sense to me. And I'd be interested, actually, you know, we actually live near my old boss from neonates. And I might actually ask him about this and see what he thinks, because I think this research, especially from a neonatal perspective, I think will be incredibly interesting, because it will just, I think we'll enter something here that we won't go back from. And I think you mentioned about the potential for reducing asthma there. That's one thing. That's one thing of many, because we're talking about the microbiome in adults and what the effect can be on the gut brain axis and the, like, immuno, like, stuff and like autoimmune. And there's lots of things that we're talking about the gut microbiome in adults, but you think, like, even just in relative size terms, like, a baby is much smaller and its microbiome might be having a much larger effect, but actually you're setting the building blocks for later in life too with the microbiome at that point. And, you know, what the body's exposed to then, it might get used to and all the rest of it, and will be setting you up for later life. And so actually optimizing that as a child is growing seems arguably more important potentially. And you wonder what else we're going to either prevent or treat, or, you know, there's lots that this opens up to. So yeah, my reaction is not one of a man there. It's one of just a scientist that finds this incredibly interesting.
And I also think the other really exciting thing about this is the power of data, where you've obviously you've been doing research and you've come across this finding that you weren't looking for, that again has really significant consequences. And I really think that speaks to, I guess, like the future of healthcare and the future of health and how different that could look with this uptick and now greater understanding and appreciation of data and how valuable it can be in understanding human beings and on a population level, but also on an individual level. And, you know, I think this really does show that it's just the beginning of us discovering so many things, like James says, about the human body that should, like, are mind-blowing in the fact that we have never established that yet, or we haven't established that yet. When we do, it would seemingly be obvious. I think it's really cool.
One thing that actually really, really interests me about this is that anaerobic bacteria component. That is something that, if you now just extrapolate this, you know, you think of the law of large numbers here. You think of the amount of people that who parents that have been storing breast milk in an environment that is aerobic, i.e. contains oxygen. That has been having an effect at population level for decades, hundreds of years. Like, that has been having an effect for that amount of time, that anaerobic bacteria have been destroyed in stored milk. So you just have to think, like, even conservatively about what the effect of that might be. But then positively, you think, well, if everyone now starts storing breast milk anaerobically to preserve the good anaerobic bacteria, what effect does that now have in the future at population level? I think that is something that really fascinates me.
Exactly. And you make a good point there. The thing is, there are actually studies that show that babies who are fed milk indirectly are more likely to have respiratory infections, are more likely to become obese. But nobody's really put two and two together. Yeah. You then have a different set of studies that will show you, we've done analysis on the breast milk microbiome, and we've shown that pumped milk is different to naturally expressed milk. But nobody has put the pieces of the puzzles together. And I think I think we could be onto something really big here. Well, I believe we are onto something really big. And I'm really excited to put this not only in the hands of parents, but also clinicians. So a big problem at the moment on a preterm ward is if a baby is born preterm and is in NICU, often they are away from their mother. Often the mother will have difficulties in expressing or latching. And often those babies are fed stored milk in the fridge. And if we could maintain, preserve that breast milk microbiome of those mothers, we could be improving the health of those very vulnerable little humans in our population. And one disease in particular I'd like to talk about is necrotizing enterocolitis.
Absolutely.
So necrotizing enterocolitis is a serious illness where essentially tissues in the gut become inflamed and start to die. And this can lead to holes that develop in the gut, which allows the content of the intestine to leak into the abdomen. And it can cause a very dangerous infection. So 10% of babies are born preterm, and NEC can happen in 10% of those preterm babies and it can lead to mortality rates of up to 50 to 60% if surgery is required. And this is a multifactorial disease that's difficult to diagnose. And the only treatment possible for it is breast milk. And it's the breast milk bacteria that helps strengthen the infant gut at this point. And what we've seen is if a baby receives breast milk, that would reduce the severity or the chances of that baby developing NEC. But if that baby is formula fed, it significantly worsens the outcome. So we're really excited at the prospect of both of our products being used in this instance to improve the health outcomes of these babies. And another point you made, James, which I really liked, is, well, why hasn't this been done? Because it sounds so obvious. And this is something that has really frustrated us over the last couple of years as well. But the thing is, the breast milk microbiome was only really discovered in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
There was a lot of controversy around whether it was a contamination or whether it was actually real. And that's because breast milk microbiome actually has a very low biomass if you can compare it to things like stool. And also, it's quite a difficult medium to analyze when you think about the lipid, the protein, the fat content. And of course, much like many other aspects of women's health, and I could go on about this for days, so I'm not going to, it's just been completely neglected. Excluded from what was called the Human Microbiome Project, even, which was this multi-million pound project that was set to characterize the different microbiomes on our bodies. But of course, no one looked at breast milk.
Yeah.
And that's why it was very important for us to really get that data first and use that data to drive innovation. We didn't want to fall into the probiotic market where you can go to a manufacturer and say, hey, I want to put strain XYZ in my product. And those strains have been from culture collections that have been around for years where no one really knows where that strain come from or what it actually does. We wanted to build the data, build the biobank, and really build something that is closer to the breast milk microbiome.
Do you know what's interesting as well, actually, that as you've said that, you know, wondering why this has not been covered, I think another reason might just be the way that medicine is structured. Because when I was thinking about it just then, there's a massive split between pediatric and adult medicine. If you're like, pediatrics is not considered, you know, small adults. Pediatrics is an entirely different field to adult medicine. And then neonates and NICU, neonatal intensive care, neonates is different again. NICU, arguably the same as neonates there, but NICU is the intersection of anesthetics, intensive care, and pediatrics. So not only is it a pediatrician, it's actually a specialized pediatrician that's there. So now, like, the research field for that, the academics in that are the academics of pediatrics and then of the ones that have specialized into neonates and NICU. So now we're even further from adult medicine, which that's one path down to find it. But actually then you think about, what is this the intersection of? That's the intersection of neonates, which is that convoluted path, but also pregnancy, which is obstetrics, but then also breast milk, which is actually normal pregnancy outcome. And so that's a normal person. And so this, and I remember saying this to Jessica the day, and a few other people, like, I remember, or maybe I said it in this podcast actually, that when I started on neonates, my consultant said to me, you all need to remember that this is the only place in the hospital where normal things are happening. We're just supervising. There are not ill people here. These are people just delivering babies. That's a completely normal human process. And I think we don't, it's not that we should be medicalizing all of this, but we have to when it comes to doing the research and the rest of it. So we have to find who it is and where it is we're going to do the research. I think this just falls between the cracks. This just falls between the cracks of a few different specialties, I guess, or needs a few different specialties to come together. Or you could argue either or any of those specialties could do it. They probably just assume the other one is doing it or whatever it is. But I think it's just it's in an interesting place just with the structure of medicine that it just won't, I don't think, get the attention that a specific gastric pathway in adults would, because someone has just naturally specialized into that with a load of other people, if you know what I mean. So maybe there's something here just about the structure of medicine. Other people might disagree, they're listening, but I don't know, that comes to mind for me anyway.
Okay, well, there you have it. The breast milk microbiome is something that we all need to be paying attention to. It's clearly incredibly important for genuinely the future of healthcare. So watch this space with Boobie Biome and how they're taking over the breast milk world. I'm very, very excited to see what happens. And I can't wait to see your products come to market. It's going to be such an amazing moment for you.
You know, I'm so excited as well. Moving from being a group of six scientists in a lab playing around with a prototype to really have something on the market is so exciting. And I honestly can't wait.
Yeah, that is such an epic journey. And yeah, we will be cheering you on the whole way. But continuing on a theme, let's talk about some news. And we may as well make it women's health and health tech news while we're here. First story today is about the Maven Clinic. And lots of people listening, I'm sure, will know who the Maven Clinic are. They are a women's health online clinic that works predominantly with employers to support women through their life journey experiences, but in particular with fertility. And they have recently announced that they're expanding their fertility support to support men as well as women by providing a trying to conceive health coaching program and dedicated support to help tackle men's fertility. And I think that this is just super exciting. And I think for me, it links in a sort of tangential way to breastfeeding, in the sense that there's a lot of like narrative, I think, around lots of these topics, particularly around pregnancy, sexual health, fertility, that are so taboo and just not talked about, that ultimately really just doesn't serve anybody. And I think that unfortunately men are as much of a victim of that as women can be. And I think I was reading earlier that infertility is often, you know, as we talk about it, it's often attributed to women because they are growing the baby inside of them, they're birthing a baby. But actually, the paper that I read, which was actually an old one, it's from, I think, 2009, and it was a US, some US research, said that a third of infertility is related to the woman in a partnership, a third related to men, and a third related to both. And so it shows just how split that issue is. And because I think there is this kind of social narrative that predominantly it is women, that means that I think it makes it really difficult for men to talk about and maybe question whether or not there might be something that needs to be addressed. But that also means that there are so many couples who are struggling to conceive that could, and that could be addressed in probably in a relatively simple way and far more quickly. But because of this narrative, it's just not, there's not a spotlight being shone on it. People don't know about it and it's not being talked about. So people don't even know to access care. So this was really exciting to see the fact that there is this kind of dedicated space and place that men can go to address those needs and talk about it and explore it. I just feel like that's really exciting. And I think it probably, as I say, ties in really neatly with some of what you hear around, you know, how people perceive breastfeeding and the stigma attached to doing that or not doing it and all of those kinds of things. But yeah, what do you make of this story and the news from the Maven Clinic's new service?
So I feel a bit embarrassed coming here to talk about the Maven Clinic because it's not the first podcast I've been on to talk about how much I love the Maven Clinic. So I feel like a bit of a fangirl. But here we go. Like I said, I love what they're building. Mm. As Jessica touched on, it's this virtual women and family clinic that offers online network of services, fertility, pregnancy, adoption, and so on. And what I think that's so unique about their approach is how they're not just focusing on the medical aspect of fertility. They also offer the mental health, the nutrition, the emotional support. So really acknowledging that fertility is more than just biology. It's about the whole person and their well-being. And I've honestly been so inspired by their inclusivity to parenthood. So talking about, you know, whether it's a 38-year-old woman who wants to freeze her eggs or a couple exploring a non-traditional path to parenthood or a woman suffering from postnatal depression because she can't breastfeed. Mm. So really, it's no surprise to me that they're now extending the services to include male as well. Mm. And I'd really love to hear your take on this, James, because Jessica made a really good point about how historically, a lot of this burden and focus has been on women when it comes to fertility or infertility. And is this because men feel emasculated talking about it? Is it because of this idea that men have more time? Or is it because for the first time, there is more research surrounding infertility in women, which has removed men from the equation? But at the end of the day, it does really take two to tango. And I had also read a stat that often if infertility is in the question, around 40 to 50% of these cases are due to the male factor infertility.
Yep.
And of course, when you come to grief and sadness related to miscarriage or the anticipation of starting a family, these feelings are not only reserved for women. So I would love to hear what your thoughts are about that, James, and how you think such services could help.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. And it it talks to something that I've been, I actually did a talk on Wednesday about something that relates to this, but I'll get into that. On your question about, you know, why men perhaps don't consider it their problem, let's just say, or are afraid to turn towards it and face it, I think it is a big demon to turn in and face, first of all, for anybody, male, female, or however you identify. I think it's a big, big, big demon to look at, and requires a lot of bravery no matter what. I think on the three things that you mentioned, the sort of the women narrative that we have now being fertility, I think, yes, that is a reason. I think it's been historically considered the woman's issue, and therefore, yes, there is then reticence by some men, whether that's because of education or whatever it is, to look at themselves. So I think that would be part of it. Yes. Is it emasculating? Yes, I can imagine it is. I can imagine that's linked in some way to the fact that, well, let me speak personally as well. I'm not someone who does a lot of the quantified self stuff anyway. I'd rather not know. Like, you know, I don't wear a wearable because it irritates me that it tells me what to do. Like, I don't need to track my sleep because I know how tired I feel in the morning. Yeah, right. Like, I know how tired I am in the morning, whether I need to, and like, the answer is go to bed earlier if you're tired. Like, why do you need an app to tell you? We can have that debate separately with the sleep expert perhaps, but like, I personally just don't need that stuff. Other people though feel very empowered by that. And I know that from a women's health perspective, it's empowering to know how your hormones are tracking through the month, through your cycle, because certain symptoms that you're feeling because of that, you now feel more control over that. I can understand and appreciate and respect that massively. And so I think, again, speaking personally, I'll speak, you know, with Jessica and I. Jessica is a big fan of the quantified self. I am not. So in our example, not that I want to generalize this to all males and all females, but in our example, I'm someone who it would require more for me to then turn in and face that demon, because I'm just not used to getting that sort of information and then acting on it. It's just not part of my DNA to understand the intricacies of all of that stuff. And even when I'm ill and unwell, I'd rather not take medication because I don't want to mask anything. I want to, if I need to suffer, I'll suffer. Like, I'm just that sort of person. And so it is then going to take more for me, but I don't want to generalize that to all men, but I think that can be something that men might feel. The other one you mentioned was more time. Is it because men just think they've got more time? I don't think men actively think they've got more time. I just think they naturally don't think about time at all. In the conversations that I've had with my friends and all the rest of it, the time element is just not a consideration. So when you think about the length of time that it would need to try and be successful, the timing element isn't the thing. And so it's more of like a, it's more just sort of planning in your mind, like, oh, if we have one now, and then, you know, you wait a year and then you have another, then I'll be 42. Like, we think of age as like, is it restrictive from a physical capacity, perhaps more so than a, there's literally a time at which we won't be able to do this anymore. And so, yeah, I think because of that lack of time pressure, we don't need to have a conversation with ourselves as men as to, if there's anything wrong, we need to get it sorted because we have X amount of time to sort it. So I don't think that it's not like an ignorance. It's not like a complacency. I think it just doesn't exist as a pressure, and therefore it affects behavior, if you know what I mean. So I don't want to be pejorative in that sense. Like, I don't think it's the thing that men are necessarily doing wrong in that instance, but I think it is contributing, yes, because it's just something that isn't needed to be thought about and perhaps should be, in terms of at least, you know, empathy when it comes to considering that for your other half in this whole equation. But in terms of what the Maven Clinic are doing and how they're doing it, I think the way that you described it was really interesting, that it's holistic. it's considering the mental health components, it's considering the coaching and the one-to-one support and all that sort of stuff. I think for everything that I've just talked about, that is incredibly important to bring some men to the table, because actually that's going to be the bit which has the empathy required to get a human on board with all of this. And so that the information that's at the other end of some of these tests isn't devastating, does come with an action plan, but comes with a human at the other end of it to deliver that news and information. Because I think one of the things that some men struggle with is just accessing healthcare full stop, because they well, for whatever reason. We know that men do that less. Women are far more likely to do that. And I think it's improving with younger generations and things, but men are just more, well, they're less likely, aren't they, to access the healthcare system for whatever ailment that they've got. And so I think that hand-holding element, whilst you don't want to call it that, I guess, if you're aiming for a more masculine audience, but the more supportive way of doing that, knowing that another human being is going to be on the other side guiding you through this, and giving you just that support and information and guidance and all the rest of it. It doesn't have to be like paternal or maternal or like, you know, touchy feely soft stuff necessarily. For those people, it just needs to be like the practical guidance of the journey through it, and just actually a human delivering the information with then an action plan rather than anything else. I think that can be comforting to actually just increase the access and increase the amount that people are doing that. I will say though, like N equals one in this study, like I am talking a bit from my personal experience, a bit from that of my friends and a bit from my wider network. I'm not talking necessarily for a whole population of men here. But I guess that's just my instinct. That's just my feeling based on like the information I have from the people that I sort of know and interact with.
And I think you've touched on quite a good few points there. Of course, you're speaking from your own personal experiences of all your friends. But also, I think this could have a huge difference on the outcomes of men wanting to adopt, for example. Mm. So men are actually 2 times more likely than women to adopt. Or if we think about same-sex male couples, surrogacy, for example, may often be the only choice for them to have a biological child. And what we've not really spoken about is how there is so much stigma and discrimination around the world when it comes to things like adopting by a single man or same-sex couples adopting. And I really think that offering things like mental health support via Maven, fertility education, adoption, surrogacy coaching, could really help those people feel acknowledged, being seen on the websites, being seen in the ads, being heard in the dialogues, and then also hopefully positively influencing society's perception of what fertility and infertility really is. But something else I wanted to pick up on is what you said on timing. And I find it really interesting because men do also have a biological clock. So sperm motility can actually decrease over the years. And often it depends on the age and the quality of the egg as well. But I think the issue is this is, people are talking about this a lot more when it comes to women. We spend our teenage years sort of thinking, oh, you're not allowed to get pregnant. Boom, you reach the age of, I don't know, mid-20s, and everyone's asking, when are you going to get pregnant? Everyone's telling you, oh, this is going to happen in your 30s, your egg reserve's going to lower, by 40s you're going to hit menopause. It's a conversation that's quite scary for women, and something that we're really not talking about as much when it comes to men. But it was interesting to hear your thoughts on that and how that wasn't a worry for you or amongst your friends.
It's a very good point. I've said this many times before, and I'll say it again, it's a two-person problem masquerading as a one-person problem, fertility. And you're absolutely right. Like this thing that gets me, and I've said this on this podcast before, like the thing that gets me is that women are told you must not, you cannot, these are all the ways not to, you've got all these options not to, like, you don't want, you've got morning after, you've got contraception, you've got barrier, you've got hormonal, so you've got better. This, you've got this, you're practically, you've got devices, you've got the, all this stuff to absolutely don't. And it's not on a gradient. There's just a single point in time at which this now flips to, you've now got to optimize everything you possibly can in order to get pregnant, because there's a huge risk of infertility. And the fact you've not been and it's just like, whoa, like, hold on a minute. This, should this not have been like a softer drop into this, like a parachute? Should we not have, maybe we, and then it's the sort of retrospective information of like, oh God, maybe you should have come off this contraception earlier, because we could have, you know, comfortably handled a child and had, we both knew we wanted to, like, why couldn't we have entered a more ambiguous period rather than now this like pressure to do so? And I don't know. It's, yeah, and this is and that's talking from personal experience as well, seeing my friends go through all this and like all of a sudden like the confusion and frankly the stress and the regret actually sometimes of why didn't we do things differently earlier, like in a more fertile window. And you're right about men, you know, men's motility, morphology, all the rest of it will decrease over time, and like it's I don't know. There's a lot of people that wish they had the information earlier. Let's just put it that way. And things might have been slightly different. But I think we're doing the right thing here. I think this is a societal change. This is like a culture change, isn't it? And I think these are the types of conversations that are useful, because people then talk about it and then, you know, things change, at least on an individual level. And society starts to just have different conversations, speak differently about it. And I think that's, you know, the most important thing that we can hope for after this, right? Where people just start talking about this stuff a bit more and considering like, hey, should we come off contraception a bit earlier? Because we both want kids and who knows how fertile we are. Maybe even it starts conversation about tracking fertility from a younger age. I know that's what Helen was talking about with fertility and like, actually why aren't we all just tracking fertility much earlier to start making big life decisions much earlier if we want, need to, etc. Yeah, it's an interesting change of paradigm, because actually, you know, as a man, for example, like why wouldn't you test your sperm motility from the age of 18 and just track it and see at what rate is it declining? And therefore, you know, oh, actually this now affects how I talk to people in my dating era and all the rest of it with how I want to, you know, find someone to settle down with and the rest of it. And the same for women, and that you might come together at a point where like, you know, we're both at a point where our maximum fertility is much earlier than perhaps normal. And actually we should make that decision now if we both want to. Like, that's interesting to me. Like, that's really interesting to me. That society becoming much more educated and informed, but does go against what I literally just said at the start, which is that, you know, me and a lot of other men don't want to know that stuff early. And actually we need to, you know, get our act together and like change that mentality first, perhaps.
I'm glad you've changed your mind throughout the course of this conversation, James.
Yeah, well, there you go. I've educated myself. I've just, yeah, logic argumented myself out of my initial position.
Yeah, it's funny what you're saying about tracking from an earlier age, because as I say, I don't want to speak for everyone on this call, but James and I are probably the last generation to have grown up without social media, having got it like in our teenage years, I guess. But now children are obviously growing up with social media. And I was having a conversation with someone yesterday who said their daughter started their period about 6 months ago. And she was so excited because she gave her flow and showed her how to track her periods and was able to give her all of this information. She was able to talk to her about period pants and, you know, moon cups and all sorts of different things that were just never part of the conversation when I was growing up. But she also said, like, isn't that an amazing gift that my daughter potentially could have her entire lifetime, well, reproductive lifetime of data that is capturing information about her hormonal experience right from the get-go, which then puts her in such an amazing position to, as you say, James, be able to have these more mindful and informed conversations and mature conversations. Like, we don't have the maturity to have those conversations because we don't have the data, I don't think, but also because that data hasn't been explained to us. Sex education didn't feature any of this stuff for us. And so I just think that it's a really, there are lots of like terrifying things I think about, like social media and technology and that sort of thing, or what it means for a new generation. But with things like that, I think it's so exciting, and there's so much opportunity for people to be able to make much more intentional decisions and not feel so much fear that, as you rightly say, James, as a girl and as a woman you grow up with, you spend most of your reproductive years being terrified of getting pregnant and doing everything you can not to get pregnant. And then it's only for the shortest part of your reproductive life that you then are desperate to have a baby, and you're putting everything into that and are so focused on it. And then you're really upset when it's not happening when you think it should, and that kind of thing. Like it could really prevent like the mental health load, I think, because you're right in saying, I think that it's one of the amazing things about the Maven Clinic. I don't think you appreciate, whether it's however you're trying to have a baby or not trying to have a baby, you don't appreciate all of the mental load and the burden that comes with that, even if you're going through a normal fertility process, you know, or, you know, experience where you're just, you're tracking your cycles, you're trying to conceive when you're ovulating. You know, I hear from all of my friends who are doing the same thing, the pressure of the 2 week wait once you've ovulated. That's so stressful at a time where stress is having such an impact on this biological process that is happening within you. And it is so multifactorial, but, you know, tracking your hormones is great, but there's so many other elements to it that you kind of just forget about. So I think it's, yeah, incredibly cool. And I just love the fact that it is opening up a conversation that is clearly, as we've established today, so needed. Okay, well, our second story today comes from Fierce Biotech, and it announces the launch of a voice-activated AI-powered ultrasound machine for women's health from GE. There's a lot of buzzwords in there, a lot of buzzwords, but apparently they have launched a new ultrasound technology that is equipped with AI that assists with diagnosis and obstetric exams. And one of the things that I found interesting and potentially exciting was that they say that it provides even higher level image quality for ultrasound examinations. And as well as doing all sorts of different things through automation and reducing the number of keystrokes for technicians and that kind of thing. What I was excited to see was that it, because of this improved image quality, they think that it will help to spot hard to diagnose conditions like endometriosis earlier. And we know that, you know, broadly, women's health conditions have such a long diagnostic odyssey. We know that endometriosis in particular takes years and years and years and lots of invasive procedures before people receive a diagnosis. And it can be a really traumatic experience for people. And, you know, it talks about how it's able to map fibroids, which we know is not an insignificant issue either. And so, you know, it's amazing. Again, linking back to what James said, like, I can't believe this hasn't happened before. Something as simple as improving the quality of an image is going to help with this improved diagnosis, which seems so obvious. And again, leaves me asking, why has this not already happened? Because we have such great imaging capabilities. When I think about iPhone cameras and DSLRs and all that kind of thing, which I am well aware that is very different to an ultrasound scanner, but it kind of just feels like those kinds of imaging technologies are behind the expectations that we have for other imaging technologies that are more mainstream and consumer focused. So yeah, what's your take on this one, Sinead?
Yeah, so I think we're living in an unfortunate reality, really, where maternal and newborn mortality rates are alarmingly high. Or as you said, the time it takes for gynecological conditions like endometriosis, for example, to be detected is very long. And one of the reasons for this is, of course, the lack of access that we have to diagnostic tools. So I'm really excited by a technology like this one, because in a field as complex as women's health, the undeniable truth is that timing is everything. So that window to reach the timely diagnosis can be so narrow, and it can be the difference between an effective treatment or prolonged suffering that has irreversible complications. And so, as you said, now the ability to identify things like fetal anomalies or gynecological conditions like endometriosis, using AI to generate these higher quality images is just nothing short of revolutionary, in my opinion. And also, you know, reading about how it can reduce the time it takes to do trimester exams, for example, by 40%, is just exactly what our healthcare system needs.
Yeah.
Because let's be honest, we are lacking manpower, or I should say woman power. And clinicians have such a high workload, it's pushing them to breaking point.
Mm.
And I know personally, so many individuals in this situation who are considering leaving the healthcare industry. And so if we can use these tools to help reduce the workload, it's really a step closer to saving our healthcare system. But it's not, of course, just about them. It's about the patient experience. And doing things like voice-activated control is really going to boost more interaction with patients. So although it is sort of voice-activated, I really do think that it will make healthcare feel more human. But I guess one thing I sort of wanted to touch on, and it'd be really interesting to hear your opinion on this, is whether AI and ultrasounds has its own sort of unique set of obstacles. Of course, like AI, we all know it's only as good as the data it receives. I'm not going to give you a ramble on that. But something that crossed my mind was, if you think about something like MRI imaging, the image being produced is going to be very reproducible. Whereas I can imagine with something like an ultrasound, I have never done an ultrasound, by the way. I've never, never operated one, so I couldn't tell you for sure. But I would think that it would be significantly dependent on, you know, the ability and the experience of the person performing it, or the compliance of the patient, or the depth of the target of the lesion, for example. And I do think that this can make it difficult to apply AI to. And of course, I imagine the company's already doing this, but I think just really reinforcing how there is a need to do things like standardize image acquisition protocols or developing different algorithms that can adapt in varying conditions are the things that we need to think about and be wary about moving forward. Because as you know, the way that these tools work, the more time and exposure we give them, the more data is collected, the more effective they become. So it'd be interesting to hear if you had any thoughts around that.
I do, because I have done ultrasounds. I'm opinionated on literally everything.
Particularly AI though.
And particularly AI, and particularly how it affects how patients feel in a consultation as well. But no, I'm somewhat qualified. I'm not an ultrasonographer. I've not done this extensively, but when I was an anaesthetist, we used the ultrasound machine a lot. We use it to find blood vessels. We use it to put in central lines. We use it to put in arterial lines. We use it to put in a lot of lines, basically blocks as well. So we're looking for nerves, and we find a space to put local anesthetic into, and we can block a specific nerve in order to do an operation pain-free on a certain area of the body, that kind of thing. So yes, I've used ultrasound a fair amount, and you're absolutely right. Does it depend on the clinician's skill? Yes. Does it depend on the clinician's experience? Yes. Is patient compliance a big deal? Absolutely it is. Is the depth of the target a deal? Yes, it is, because at a different depth, you need to use a different setting. At that different setting, you might get less quality. And also at a different depth, things might be above it. Bones, for example, might be above it, which then might block the view underneath. And so, yes, there are lots and lots of different things at play here. But the point is, lots of different things at play in order to achieve the correct quality of the image. That is absolutely right. I think, though, that generally it is standardizable in terms of finding that image for an experienced radiographer, sonographer, that type of thing. I think most will get a replicatable image in some way, enough so for the right artificial intelligence computer vision software to then work on it. I actually think that I did an article for Forbes a long time ago on a new device called the Butterfly IQ. It was new at the time, like a handheld ultrasound device made with a semiconductor, and they changed loads of different bits and bobs. You could plug it into an iPhone and get an image. It's point of care ultrasound, POCUS, was coming in at the time. And so this was like a real kind of enabler for that. And the software for Butterfly IQ at the time, I can't remember whether it was in the software, whether they were talking about it being in the software, because I interviewed a lot of people for that article. But they were saying that based on the image, it's actually possible to give direction to the ultrasonographer to make the image a higher quality. Like, they might say, this is the wrong angle, you'll need to pivot the angle, it's the wrong this, you might need to. So it was actually starting to give those sort of like Google Maps directions on the screen of like what you actually needed to do to actually enhance the image. And of course, by doing those things, it will then feed back and it will learn whether it's right, wrong, better, worse, and therefore it will change the direction. So it was at least being talked about, if not actually implemented at the time. So I think that stuff is actually possible. But most sonographers, I think, will get a relatively standardized image from what I experienced anyway. Anaesthetist's completely different story. One anaesthetist to the next might be wildly different, I can tell you that for a fact. completely correct versus not. I've been in both of those camps plenty of times. So my images were not replicatable like in the slightest, and would have greatly benefited from said directions.
Don't give you the AI tool. James.
Absolutely. I'll be the first one to take that AI tool. Well, certainly would have been at the time. Yeah. No, there was no ego here for how good my images were. But did pride myself in being able to hit a vessel at some point. Not as an F1, but as an anaesthetist, I could. So a few years later I could hit a vessel when I wanted to. But yeah, interesting. It's nice what you said as well about, yes, it helps the clinician. But yes, it also helps the interaction between the clinician and the patient. Things like the voice activation, less keystrokes, like all of this stuff starts to divert attention. Just one big thing that is on my mind currently with the way that we're trying to change things in health tech is that I want for the space that we continue to be focused on improving that interaction as much as we can, because of the value of patient experience. And I think shining a light on this as an important factor is important, because in a world where AI can do everything, should it? Should AI not only move the ultrasound probe on the body itself by a robotic arm, but it could also then deliver the diagnosis with a percentage chance of what you've got and a differential. It can then give you a treatment plan, and it can print that out for you. It can hand it to you, and you wouldn't need to see a human at all potentially for what AI can do. But should it? And for me, the answer is a massive no, because the front door of healthcare is and should remain human. AI should never be alone at the point of human suffering. And therefore, a human always has to be the interface between the AI and the patient. But that is a beautiful thing, that the AI can literally do everything else. But the human can be the one that can display true empathy with that other human being in the room and give them the best possible patient experience, which for me is not possible with just AI and robotics and computers. And so that, I think, is a really important thing, that it can reduce the amount of time it takes a human to do something. What we're not talking about is the AI taking over and doing everything. And at the same time, we're talking about retaining this human, clinician-patient interaction, and we're talking about benefiting the interaction. I think that interaction is something that I don't want us to be in a place where we start talking about removing that. I think always in a place of optimizing it is perfect, which is what you said. Like, I think that is a really just important thing to keep talking about here, because as I say, with large language models, we are in a world where we now have a very interesting interface with AI, that it can communicate with us in the way that we like to be communicated to. I just don't think that is appropriate in healthcare, and we need to make sure it does everything except that.
Exactly. It's that emotion and empathy piece, isn't it? And just how important it is for general well-being. If you're talking about diagnosis, if you're talking about anything, you need to do that with a human being. And I think there's become this perception amongst the general population of people being terrified that AI and robots are going to take over. Personally, I don't think that will ever be the case. But yeah, I think the emotion, empathy aspect is important, and hopefully these type of tools will free more time for the clinician to do just that.
Exactly.
Okay, well, moving on to our final and breaking story, which was announced right before we came on the airwaves to record this on Friday morning, is that Sifted have reported that LV have raised a 9.6 million something round, unclear what they're calling it. They raised a Series C back in 2022, raised some more money in, no, 2021, raised some more money in 2022, and then there's a bit more money now. So unclear what the labels are, but I think that's kind of been thrown to the wind in the investment world recently. I don't know what labels are being used, probably animals at this point. But it's awesome to see, obviously, some funding come through to the women's health space. But I wanted to talk broadly, while we have you, about what you're hearing from your kind of peers and colleagues on the ground about what the appetite is from investors at the moment to invest in game-changing, life-changing, very important solutions, technologies, companies doing really incredible things. What's your sense at the moment? How is it feeling?
Of course, so it's great hearing the announcement that LV has just raised, because we need more money in women's health, especially when it comes to the breastfeeding space. So that's really exciting. But speaking on my own personal experiences and amongst other founders that I know, today's market is pretty tough out there. We've seen how, you know, investment levels are falling between sort of 63% between 2021 and 2023. And I can vouch for that. It is really difficult out there. We've been fundraising for a couple of months at the moment. And thankfully, we do have small little light at the end of our tunnel, which is lovely. But I know for some others, that is not the case. And I think the issue is, in 2021, we just saw this huge rise in valuations, especially in digital health. And now it's not unusual for those companies who had the million, multi-billion pound valuations to be having a down round or be raising on the same valuations. Mm. And that's now making it a lot more difficult for smaller companies to raise. But this is not just in the sort of women's health, digital health space. I think we're also seeing a lot in direct-to-consumer. So venture capital are scared of direct-to-consumer. They would prefer to invest in simpler B2B, more reliable business models. And I think that's making it very difficult. Something that we found quite challenging is how we sit kind of at the interface of hardcore biotechnology. Mm. So the shotgun, the metagenomic, the sort of deep tech that's going on, but also consumer health, and really finding the right investor that wants to dabble in those two things simultaneously is really difficult, because the biotech investors will understand how we need a lot of money to do the research, or we're not going to launch a product to market without doing clinical trials. But then the consumer type VC will want to see, well, how fast are we going to be getting our return? And I think in the current climate, that's becoming more pronounced, which is making things a lot more difficult. But on the whole, I do think it's getting better. I think I've sat on too many panels and listened to too many people talking about how rubbish the climate is. And I'm quite looking forward for us to move away from that. So it's really exciting to see how more companies are doing rounds. Again, like you said, Jessica, I'm not sure what the names of these rounds are, whether they're animals, whether they're what they are. But just seeing more money being deployed, I think, is a positive sign. And it's something that we've seen as well. It has become a little bit easier to raise now than what it was around 12 months ago.
You are a good company as well. So it's likely that you will find it slightly easier than others are talking about. The good company still raise, etc.
Thank you. I will take that. I will take that. So I think smaller companies like us really need to take advantage of what government funding is available. We have been so lucky applying for things like Innovate UK grants. Mm. I think we've won around 2.6 million in total from grants. Mm. And, you know, you don't have to give any equity away from that. It's
ideal.
Double whammy. So I think smaller companies like us at the moment, rather than trying to get that big seed or that big Series A, really try and leverage on those smaller grants and raise less just to get us through this period of time, which can be quite uncertain.
Yeah, I also wonder whether one of the challenges is that because there isn't a lot of money for women's health in the system, and we're seeing cuts actually being made around women's health at point of care, that therefore a lot of women's health solutions are left with few options. The two options are either consumer or corporate. And consumer is renowned to be really challenging in terms of launching products, getting market traction. And, you know, obviously, as you say, from a biotech perspective, that the biotech investors know and understand the value, importance and cost of research and doing that properly. But it's an uphill struggle, I think, in a consumer market. And it's really difficult because it's a healthcare product that is reliant on consumers paying for it, where in an ideal world, we'd want to see these kinds of solutions being embedded like a really critical part of the health system and healthcare. And so I think that's one of the reasons why women's health companies have it even harder, because as you rightly say, like, who do we turn to? Where do we go? Where do we belong and where do we fit? Because I've definitely seen like a positive narrative and like at a very high level, a positive indication, investors are saying, yes, of course, we need to invest in women, in women's health. But that hasn't yet translated to practice. And I don't necessarily know why that is. It's good to see the conversation that tide is shifting, but it kind of doesn't really mean anything until we actually see it change in practice. And I think women's health companies need to feel like there is a more obvious place for them to go, where they are heard, understood, and the impact and potential of what they're doing is really viscerally felt. So yeah, I think it's super interesting. But as you say, hopefully we are on the cusp of things getting a bit better, and it's nice to see these kind of these indicators that perhaps things are moving in the right direction. And hopefully, definitely sometime soon, we're going to be raving about your announcement when you've closed your race.
Something is coming.
It definitely, awesome. It definitely is. Well, we have kept you for long enough, and this has been such a great conversation. It has flown by, despite the fact that we have kept you much longer than most of our other guests. But we cannot let you go without saying congratulations for being recently named alongside your co-founder Tara as Forbes 30 Under 30. So, well done. That is just such an incredible accolade. And how does it feel to be in the Hall of Fame?
Thank you so much. Yeah, it's been so great, actually. The last few weeks has been a little bit crazy. What was actually quite surprising to see was that by being on the Forbes list, it's actually opened the doors to so many more women who want to donate breast milk. Mm. We now have like a backlog of emails because we just can't cope with how many people want to donate, which is just fantastic, because not only is it boosting our story to the likes of investors, but also to the community of women.
Wow.
And those are the people that we want to target and want to be involved in our company at the moment. So it's been a really pleasant surprise, actually. So no, thank you.
Yeah, fantastic. Really, really impressive stuff. And I think we can end with a call out to any investors who have been inspired by today's conversation and are looking for somewhere to deploy their capital where they're going to get an amazing return. Hit Bupa Biome up.
This is not investment advice, etc.
It's definitely not. But yeah, thank you so much for joining us. And to our pigeon listeners, we will see you all and maybe speak to you all next week.